I'm DJ, I'm an alcoholic.
My
sobriety date is August 10th of 2009. I have a sponsor in Midtown as my home group. Sam, thank you so much for asking me to speak out here. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be able to do anything for AA, and it's beautiful out here this way, so appreciate that as well. So I don't want to spend too much time on my drunk log just because a lot's happened to me in sobriety. Grew up in the D.C. area. During most of my childhood, I was very anti-drinking, anti-drug. I had like a little DARE sticker on my room door because probably I didn't want to do it at the time. And also, my mom and dad were both drinkers, and they fought a lot when I was young. And pretty much every time they fought, they were drinking. So from the longest time, I told myself, you know what, I'm not going to drink because I don't want to turn out like them. And I'd go to high school parties like that and not drink and be fine with it until I was on a trip for one class and we were overseas where it was legal for me to drink. And I'm like, you know what, I can have a few drinks because, you know, my family's Irish and German, so I'd have a beer on St. Paddy's Day, champagne on New Year's, you know, and I never felt the effect produced by alcohol. But on this trip, we were in a bar and I'd been drinking and drinking and drinking. And all of a sudden, something switched in me. You know, all of a sudden, the room got brighter. All of a sudden, I got funnier. People got better looking. I became everything that I had wanted to be for a brief moment there. And ever since then, whenever I drank, I sought to try and match that feeling again. Now, this is in France, where I can barely speak French when I'm sober. And this is an exchange trip. And I figured, you know what, just leave me here. When we go out tonight, just come pick me up from the bar. And not realizing, I had no idea how to get back to my host family's house. I had no idea where I was, and I couldn't speak any language well enough at that point to get back to where I needed to be. That was just, from the get-go, I'm like, just leave me here in the bar. You know? And so I come back home, started seeking it out more and more from then on. Like trying to get to those parties, you know, I started seeking out people who did the things I wanted to do. I started getting into drugs because they were a lot more easily accessible than alcohol at the time. And, you know, of course, right about junior year, my grades started dropping because I stopped caring about school. I used to love playing baseball, and I walked away from a tryout just because I'm like, it's going to take up too much of my time, too much weekends. You know, and I was in fear about it. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to make the team. I don't know what, but I'd rather just go drink. And that's what I did. During my senior year of high school, my parents split up. And it was a great excuse for me. You know, why are you not coming to class? Why are you getting drunk on weekends? Why are you doing X, Y, and Z? Oh, well, my parents are getting divorced, and I'm feeling some sort of way about it. You know, and that worked for most of it. But after about 6 months of using that excuse, people started to get tired of it and realized that maybe there was something more to it. And I met with my high school counselor because apparently when you stop showing up to classes regularly and your grades drop from like A's and B's to C's and D's, they want you to talk to somebody about it. And he and I were talking. I was telling him about my life at home, how my parents were. And he suggested I go to Al-Anon. So I went with him and my dad to an Al-Anon meeting, and at which point, you know, my dad heard people talking about his drinking, and the next day he went to an AA meeting, and he's been sober since, which is great and all, except when you're still drinking and your dad wants to take you to joint AA/Al-Anon meetings on Friday nights at 8:30, that gets in the way of your drinking, you know? I don't want to sit in a room full of sober alcoholics. I want to sit in a room full of drunk alcoholics at that time. And eventually I stopped going to those too. You know, at this point I'd crossed a lot of lines that I told myself I wouldn't do. You know, I'd start stealing from people. I'd start fighting people. I'd start doing all sorts of things that I never thought I would do. You know, my parents raised me to be better than that. The first lock I actually ever picked was my parents' liquor cabinet. You know, and it gave me a nice little skill set after that. Also, a lot of people left doors unlocked in my neighborhood, so it is their fault for not securing it. And, you know, there's, it was the same, it wound up being like the same six of us, just getting hammered every night, you know, doing whatever drugs we could scrape up between us, getting drunk off whatever we had, just every night, coming to the next morning. You know, originally, or like, it started getting to the point where I didn't know where I was when I woke up. You know, it'd be like, all right, am I in my car? No. Am I in my dad's place? No. All right, where am I? Okay, I'm where I passed out the night before, where I was drinking. Or, oh yeah, I pulled over last night on my drive home because I realized I was too drunk to drive, which normally didn't stop me, but whenever I saw more than double, I usually tried not to drive then. But there was always usually something I could try and do to at least keep me awake to get home. But, and I thought that was my normal life. You know, I figured I'd be dead by 30. You know, just drug myself away into oblivion. And it went like that for a while until there was one night I was driving home. I don't remember much of what happened, but I only know from like tire tracks and the police report. But apparently I hopped the curb, went through a driveway, missed a tree, or no, it was a telephone pole, thank God. Hit a rock, like one of those like decorative boulders that was in someone's front yard for some reason. Sent that like 15, 20 feet. That bounced me back out into the road. At which, this is where I remember. I wake up and I realize that there's a car that I'm about to go into, and I ran into the back of a parked car, doing around 35, 40 miles an hour or so. The car made it down to the street and then it died on me. I tried to get it to move to drive away and it wouldn't. So I just kind of walked off, passed out down the road, got woken up the next morning by paramedics and police. They had already woken up my dad because it was his car. And they're like, hey, who might be driving your car right about now? Oh, my son. Well, do you know where he is? And I never realized how much fear I put in him that night. You know, to be woken up in the morning around 4 a.m. by police, asking him where his son is, and then he sees a mangled car with a little bit of blood on the airbag and no idea. And he told me later he was calling all the hospitals in the area, a couple police stations, a couple morgues, just to see if I had turned up anywhere. But he had made an appointment with the police for me to get charged the next day. And when the police found me, they took me home to him. And thank God for deep pockets and cargo pants, because they did not pat me down well enough that morning for me to get additional charges, and they took me home. And I'll never forget walking up to my dad's apartment building, getting out of the police car that day. He's standing outside waiting for me, and I don't know what it was, but I could finally see it in his eyes, the look of disappointment, look of shame, the look of fear, that pretty much, it looked like I had just broken this man's heart. And I mean, I know he was relieved to actually, you know, see me vertical, but, and for the first time I finally felt like I can't keep living this way anymore. You know, it was partly that, and partly just, I'm done, I quit, I don't want to live like this anymore. Because a couple months before that, those AA/Al-Anon meetings he had been taking me to, I guess something had sunk in before I stopped going to them, because I was, again, same six of us every night. I'm coming back from the bathroom after throwing up again, you know, drinking beer to get the taste out of my mouth. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm drinking pretty much every day right now. And every time I drink, I get drunk. Maybe I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, you know, if I'm an alcoholic, then either one of two things is going to happen. Either I'm going to die because of it, or I'm going to wind up like those sad losers in AA. And none of them looked appealing to me. You know, so I did the only thing I knew how to do, which was I grabbed the closest bottle and started chugging. You know, and from then on, I tried to drink myself where my mind would shut up that maybe I'm an alcoholic. Because when I was blacked out or passed out, I didn't have to have those thoughts that maybe I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'm going to die from this. But that morning, walking up to my dad, something hit me like, there's got to be a different way. And my dad looked at me. He's like, you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. All right, go pass out. We'll talk when you sober up. Because he knew damn well what had happened. And wake up. On the way to the police station that night, he told me, he said, I don't care what the cops say. I don't care what the judge says. If you want to stay under my roof, you're going to AA. And I agreed. You know, I had nothing better to do. I had no better ideas. So, I liked having my room there at his apartment. So I agreed to it. And that was July 29th, 2009. My sobriety date is August 10th. Because, like I said, the cops did not pat me down very well, and I couldn't let that stuff go to waste. You know, I had a lot going on. I had court now. I had lawyers to talk to. You know, I was trying to get sober. I couldn't do that sober. So, I started going to the same AA meetings my dad went to, you know. And they were a lot like rooms like this, you know, and I'd listen to people come in and complain about their wives, complain about their jobs, complain about their kids, and then they'd go home and stay sober. I was 19 years old. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have a job. I didn't have kids. I really didn't have anything going for me in my life. And I thought my life was over. Like, great, I'm going to go to these rooms, complain about all the things I don't have right now, and then go home and stay sober. My life's over. Great. But fortunately, I got thrown into a good young people's group in the Bethesda area. And thank God for that. The first time I was walking up there, walking up downtown Bethesda, and I see a bunch of people standing outside this place, and probably a couple hundred of them all smoking styrofoam cups of coffee, and I'm like, what the heck did I get myself into? And as I'm walking up across the street, I see a guy I went to high school with. And I hated this guy. He actually wound up making an amends to me for something he did to me. But he was usually high or drunk in high school, and I was usually hungover or coming off of something. So we never really got along. But he walks up to me and sticks his hand and is like, hey, DJ, good to see you. And he and I started talking. And he was a completely different person than the guy I had known a few years back. You know, he had gotten a couple years under his belt. He had been working a program, talking to a sponsor. And I started thinking, like, you know, if AA can work for this guy, maybe it can work for me. And that was my first instance of hope that I had that maybe there's a way out of this hell that I'm living in. And he introduced me to my first and second sponsor. And some guy I was sitting in the meeting with next to my dad. He's like, hey, why don't you go pick up a 24-hour chip? So I did. You know, later that week, people were like, hey, do you have a sponsor? Hey, do you have a sponsor? Hey, do you have a sponsor? Yeah, fine, I'll get a sponsor. So I asked somebody, and they were moving to New York in a month. So he was temporarily my sponsor. He moved, got another sponsor. Because I knew at that point kind of well enough that maybe I should get another sponsor. And so I did. I started going back to college for round two at it. And about a month and a half, 2 months later, I dropped out again. Because brand newly sober, I was not really in a good frame of mind to actually learn how to study or even memorize anything. It was hard enough memorizing the steps and the serenity prayer and all that stuff. I didn't want to memorize formulas and all that fun stuff. Dropped out again, started working. And every year my home group puts on this men's retreat. It's a great time. Go down to Front Royal for a weekend and hear a great message and come back home. And my sponsor and I made a plan that he would drive me down there. You know, day before comes, I hadn't heard anything from him. I'm calling him, no answer. Finally get a ride down with somebody else. No, don't see my sponsor that weekend because I had just done my fifth step with him. That Sunday, get back up home. About a couple hours later, my grand sponsor calls me. And he tells me, like, hey, DJ, your sponsor moved out of his house while we were gone. You should probably go find a new sponsor. Because he was off drinking now at this point. And I was fairly devastated by that. Because I just told this man my deepest, darkest secrets. And I felt abandoned, you know. I called a bunch of people, telling them what's going on, and every single one of them said the same thing to me. Get another sponsor tonight. One of my really good friends, he told me, you know, if you don't get a sponsor tonight, you're probably not going to get one, and you're probably going to go drink. because you'll just keep rolling with that excuse. So that night at my home group, I went up to somebody who, people had always told me, you know, get a sponsor who has what you want. My first sponsor, I just kind of picked him. My second sponsor, he threatened to break my arm if I didn't get a new sponsor. And my current sponsor today that I have, at the time he had a sweet pickup truck and he could make women laugh. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. I didn't have much going for me when I got here. Yeah. So I asked him that night to be my sponsor and he agreed to. And I did another fifth step with him. And God bless that man. He's saved my life more times than I can count. You know, about started going through the steps, you know, working on my sixth and seventh step with him, which he had me do it, like, write down the seven deadly sins, write down what I thought the definition of them were, and then write down the actual dictionary definition of them, which it was actually really eye-opening for me, because I always thought the one that stuck out to me the most was wrath. You know, I thought wrath was rage, angry, like, I'm going to fight you kind of rage, you know. And when I looked up the actual definition of it, it was deeply resentful indignation. And that one stuck with me because there were so many times I thought I was mad at somebody because of, you know, something righteous or, you know, I get to be angry at this person. But no, it's just the resentment. And I have to keep remembering that today, especially whenever I'm driving on 66 or 495. But, you know, we started going through my eighth step. You know, and writing down all those things I had done. Again, I was not feeling pretty good about that. It's actually seeing them on paper. And the person I had become, especially to my mom and my grandmother, they loved me. They both helped raise me as best they could. And during my drinking, I treated them like no son should ever treat their family. You know, I'd stop talking to them. I'd go a month or two without talking to either one of them, even though they lived about 5 minutes from me. You know, I didn't even see them. And my advance to my mother was to be a son to her again, you know, and to also get a college degree. But and my advance to my grandmother was to be a grandson to her again. Now, my grandma, when I was drinking, I remember the day perfectly. It was a nice summer day, kind of like today. My friend and I were opening an ice-cold 30 rack of Coors Light. And we had two girls coming over to hang out with us. And my mom calls me. And I ignored the call like I normally do. And she called me again. And for some reason, I answered. At that point, she told me my grandma was on the way to the hospital with a stroke. And I'm pissed off because she had to go and get a stroke and inconvenience my drinking. So I dropped what I was doing, go to the hospital. As soon as she was out of the danger zone, we're like, hey, she looks like she's going to be okay. We're going to monitor her overnight. I left, got absolutely hammered that night. Visited her the next day for 15 minutes, drunk and high. And then I didn't see her and my mom again for 2 months. Because it was easier for me not to show up to just drink away the guilt and shame that I felt than it was for me to actually man up and go see him. So at this point, you know, my grandma, she fell and broke her hip. She was 99 years old when that happened. So I wasn't working at the time, so every day from usually around 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., I'd visit her in her hostel, help her with rehab, order meals for her, basically just actually try and be a grandson for her. And it sucked, you know, seeing, because she was starting to fade near the end there. But there were those days when she'd wake up and recognize who I was. You know, and I was usually watching a movie or something on my laptop. She'd kind of just come to, look over, see me, and the look of peace that would come over her face made it all worth it. Just knowing I was there and taking care of her. You know, and I made the amends to her, and she's told me, you know, I'm proud of you. Keep doing what you're doing. Something's working for you. And during this time, I tried starting to be a son to my mom again. She and I didn't get along too well. A lot of that's on me. And I had some people who had been through it before too. And I started going over to her house for, you know, 10, 15 minutes at a time. And what helped me was I was working part-time construction jobs here and there. So I go over to her house, find something that needed to be fixed, fix it, and then leave. Because it was still a way I could show up for her, or I could do something for her, but I didn't have to talk to her, because if I talked to her, I'd be getting into a yelling match with her. And those 10, 15 minutes turned into 30, 45 minutes, then to me going over there, fixing something, then eating and talking to her, to me taking her out to lunch and stuff like that. And I finally became a son to her again, you know. At that point, my life was going nowhere. Like I said, just working part-time construction jobs. And I was talking to my sponsor, and I made the brilliant decision to join the Army. Which, yeah, you know, you're trying to be sober. Let's join the largest drinking fraternity in the entire world. Still not sure why you let me do it, but I got sent down to Georgia for boot camp, and about halfway through, a drill sergeant comes in, yells my name, and tells me to get in his office, which is never a good sign when someone's yelling at you to tell you to get in their office, but I walk in there, and he's like, hey, relax, guy. They had just gotten a Red Cross message that my grandma had passed away that night before. And I was shortly on the flight back. I had 2.5 days to pretty much come back here, be a pallbearer, give a eulogy, bury her, and then go back down. You know, it sucked. But I didn't know what to do, honestly. And I was calling people and telling them, like, hey, what do I do? And thank God for my sponsor. He was there that night when I flew back in for the viewing and everything. And he told me, he said, hey, be there for your mom. Because she and my dad had started to talk again. I guess having your son go off will do that for a divorced family. But she needs somebody too. And so I was there for her as best as I could be. You know, I was a shoulder for her to cry on. I talked to her, spent time with her as much as I could for 2.5 days. You know, and I was able to be there for her. And as much as it hurt me to have to try and stay strong for her, you know, I know she appreciated it, and I'm very glad I did. You know, so I leave back down to Georgia, go up to North Carolina for a bit. You know, things are going great. My dad and my mom come down occasionally to visit me. I go up there on weekends occasionally to visit them. Having a great time. Then the Army's like, hey, you're going to Texas now. I'm like, okay, cool. Guess I'm going to Texas. About a month and a half after I go to Texas, my dad calls me at about 10:30 in the morning. And he knows I'm at work. And I know he's usually at work at this time or doing something. And so I'm wondering why he's calling me. And I answer the phone. He didn't find my mother dead that morning. And thank God for friends and this program teaching me how to make friends. Because I was with somebody I worked with right when he called. And I told my friend, I'm like, hey, I don't care what you have to do. He said, don't let me go drink. You know, because I knew what would fix that hurt. I got off the phone with my dad. My first call was to my sponsor. My second call was to my squad leader. And my third call was to a friend of mine. Because I didn't know. I knew I had to get home, and that's about as much as I knew at that point. I made it back here. And I'm a wreck. You know, trying to get a last-minute flight from El Paso to Washington, D.C. is not fun. I think they had me go through Denver for some reason. I don't know why, but they did. But fortunately, Denver has a smoking section, you know, in their airport. Unfortunately, it's in a bar. But I needed a cigarette, so I went, you know. And so I'm sitting there smoking in uniform because I went straight from work to the airport and everything. And the guy comes up and is like, hey, man, you know, if you want anything to drink, let us know. It's on the house. So, I just found out my mom died, and you're offering me an open bar. God help me. And I pray them, too. Because as much as I knew what would make that hurt go away, I knew that if I picked up a drink, I wasn't making it back here. You know, I'm in an airport. I can go wherever. And didn't drink then. Came back, did the funeral, did all that fun legal stuff with it too. And started talking to people about what was going on. You know, I'd be going to the meetings I normally would go to and see my friends here. And some new guy would come up to me and talk to me about how, you know, he's pissed off at his parents after just getting out of rehab, or he's got this court case, and I'm like, I don't care about it. Inside, I said that. Outside, I tried to help because it got me out of my own head for a little bit. You know, for those 5 minutes that new guy was complaining about whatever he was complaining about, I wasn't thinking about my problems, you know. And part of the reason why I didn't drink, part of it's God, but the other part of it is I knew that AA had helped me become a son to my mother again. You know, I didn't deserve that second chance at that relationship with her, not after how I treated her. But y'all gave it to me, and y'all helped me rebuild that relationship with her. And that's partly why I didn't drink, just having that knowledge. But like, I owe it to her, you know. Granted, me constantly having people call me nonstop, like, hey, what are you doing? And my friends not leaving me alone, not letting me go hungry. You know, pretty much filling up all the time I had back here helped with that, too. But, and then I had about 2 weeks of emergency leave back here, and I had to go back to Texas. And I am eternally grateful to my home group, and because they showed up for me and my dad when I couldn't. You know, I physically could not make it back here because of the Army wanting me to be a soldier or some reason like that. But, you know, my dad and I, we had to deal with all the legal stuff with wills, with my mom's house, and everything that she didn't take great care of. And my dad and I were talking that we had no idea how we'd be able to take care of her house. You know, we knew we were going to sell it, but the place was a wreck. And a good friend of ours, he somehow wrangled together about 20 or 30 people. And they spent a weekend cleaning that place out, helping my dad label what to go to storage, what to throw, and bringing out stuff to the curb to throw away. Without me there, you know, they just did it to help somebody out. And I can't repay them personally for that. But I know today, you know, people have asked me to help with cleaning out something for their family, and I'm saying yes to that because they did it for me. And I didn't ask them to. They didn't have to do it. You know, who wants to give up a Saturday and a Sunday during the summer to go clean out somebody's dead parent's house? You know, but they did it. And my dad and I still are amazed that these people did that for us. You know, I didn't have friends like that when I was drinking. The only people I had when I was drinking were either what could I get from you or what could you get from me. You know, nobody was there like, hey, do you need help with this? Hey, how are you doing today? Do you need to go come eat? Nothing like that. You know, so I was still down in Texas for a while. And every now and then I'd come visit here. And I walked into my home group one time when I was back here visiting. And as I'm walking in, I see my second sponsor in the hallway. You know, the one who drank right after my right after my fifth step with him. And I go up to him and, you know, ask him how he's doing. You know, and at that point, I was just elated that he made it back. You know, he was on my fifth step that I did with my current sponsor. I had a nice little resentment there. And my amends to him was just to save a seat for him. You know, that maybe one day he'll make it back. You know, and after I got out of the Army and everything, I wound up living with that man. And he's one of my best friends today to the point where I consider him a brother. You know, and he's also sitting in the front row tonight right down here with me. You know. I don't know how I got that kind of relationship in my life, but I wouldn't want to miss it for the world. You know? And then, so pretty much from 2000, 2011 to 2012. I joined the Army, my grandma died, my dog died, my mom died. And then, yeah, that was a fun year. But 2014, you know, they got the orders that everybody wants to get. And, hey, you're going overseas to go to another desert. Because El Paso isn't enough of a desert for you. You need more deserts in your life. And so, you know, I talked to a bunch of people who had traveled while sober and talked to them about what they did when they couldn't get to meetings. And they told me, they gave me some suggestions, and I tried to follow them as best as I could, you know. It was hard for me to get to physical meetings because in the middle of Afghanistan, it's not really a big AA community. You know, I'd do online meetings. I'd listen to speaker tapes. I'd read. I'd talk to people, you know, and for the most part, I was working the program while I was there. And then we had a pretty rough week where in 24 hours, we had five of our forces die. Got ambushed a whole bunch of times. We get back to where we were stationed at the time, and I'm on radio guard. And I know there's a story in the Big Book where it says, you know, we could move to the North Pole and an Eskimo would show up with a bottle of whiskey and ruin it for us. And I'm sitting there listening to a radio, and two EOD guys walk in with a bottle of whiskey and ask me if I want some. And I grabbed the bottle from them, smelled it. I have never drank Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey, but good God, did it smell good that night. And it smelled like relief. But for some reason, I was honest with them. And not honest like, hey, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink this. I was honest that, hey, I'm going to drink this entire bottle. And there were two of them and one of me, and they were both bigger than me. And they said, that's all you have, and no, you're not. So they took it back from me, and I did not drink that night. And I immediately called my sponsor afterwards after realizing what had just happened. You know, that whatever pain I was feeling or anything, that the answer, the bottle would have helped for that night. But then what? Then I'm drunk and you're giving me ammo and explosives? That's not a good idea. But I called my sponsor immediately afterwards and told him what was going on. And ever since that night, you know, the connection I have with my higher power has changed a little bit from there. Because before, you know, it was, God help me do this, God help me do this. And, you know, I thought I had an understanding of him. But after that week, it changed. Because I had a lot of questions for God, and I didn't have that many answers at that point. You know, why he had taken these people from us, why I was seeing some of the things I was seeing, why I was doing some of the things I was doing, you know. And I talked to my sponsor about that. And it's something that he and I have talked about since, you know, and it's helped me. I don't want to say broaden my understanding of God because that makes me sound smarter than I am, but I've got a better understanding of him today, you know, where I can rely on him no matter what the situation is and I'm taken care of, you know, and even though I had experience at the time that showed me that, I still didn't truly have that trust, you know, and talking with my sponsor, talking with a few religious people helped with that, and it's funny how that works sometimes, you know, so we were getting ready to leave Afghanistan, and I actually got to a meeting out there, got to one meeting in 8 months, it was just me and one other guy, and I walked in there, he walked in a little bit after me, and start off me and I'm like, hey, I'm DJ, I'm an alcoholic, and I bust out laughing. Because that was the first time in 8 months I had actually said that out loud, you know. But that was one of the best meetings I had ever been to in my life. You know, him and me just talking back and forth, we had thrown rank out the window. You know, and he was excited that there was another alcoholic there. I was excited just to be in an AA meeting where I could actually see the people I'm talking to. You know. And ever since then, like, I've had people come up and be like, oh, I don't know if I can get to a meeting where, you know, when I'm on vacation here. And they usually shut up when I tell them I got to an AA meeting in Afghanistan. So, but that's my little braggart thing for today. But, get home from that. And, you know, life was good. You know, I made it back here. And then I stopped working the program. You know, I tried to be working the program. I helped start up a couple meetings in El Paso. I was working with people, talking to people. And then I started thinking, I've got this. You know, I can do this. I was justifying it, like my work schedule was crazy. I think in 3 months I had one full weekend that I didn't have to do something. You know, I'm like, oh, I don't need to go to a meeting tonight. That turned into, I don't need to go to a meeting tomorrow night. I can go out to the bar with my friends. I can go to these places. You know, the places the alcoholics probably shouldn't go. Yeah, I was going there, willingly. I was trying to justify it. Like, oh, I'm just going there to shoot pool with a friend. Or, I'm just going there to, you know, DD for my friends. Because that's really what I want to do on a Friday or Saturday night. Is drive around a bunch of drunks. And it says in the book, you know, try to make sure we aren't trying to steal some sort of vicarious pleasure, that we have a solid reason for going there. And I kind of reversed that. You know, I was there to steal the vicarious pleasure, and I had no solid reason for going. And I was resentful almost every day. And I pretty much, any semblance of a spiritual life, I really didn't have. I'd go to meetings once a week, once every other week, you know, even though I could go every day when I could, you know, when I wasn't working. You know, it's bad when your sponsor calls you to see how you're doing because he hasn't heard from you in a month. And I thought I was fine. You know, I thought I knew better. I thought I could do it on my own. Unfortunately, my contract was up. I was moving back to the area, trying to plan it out, you know. And that second sponsor I had, he's like, hey, I've got an opening at my house if you want to move in here with me. I said, sure, that actually sounds really good. And thank God I said that, because he helped get me back on the beam. I tried to do the same stuff I was previously doing, you know, like, oh, no, I'm not going to go to the meeting tonight. He'd be tell me, no, shut up and get in the car. And I'd be like, nah, dude, I really don't think I'm going to go. He's like, get in the car or I'll make you get in the car. At the time, I was in shape, and he couldn't have made me get in the car. But I did, you know, and thank God I did that, because he pretty much forced me to get service positions at meetings that I wasn't normally going to, because I didn't feel like going that night. You know, and he got me plugged back in again, and thank God for that, you know. And over time, you know, it's funny how when you actually start working your program, life gets good again. You know, and you're not pissed off every day. You're not resentful at everything around you. And you actually can show up for people. You know, and so it was a pretty good life I was living. Then in summer of 2016, my dad told me that they found a cancerous lump in his throat or in his mouth, and he had to go get surgery for it. And that same man, he spent an entire day with myself and my dad while my dad was in surgery, you know, pretty much showing up for me and being a friend for me, you know, while my dad underwent his operation. And my dad came out of it fine. As he's walking out of the hospital, he kind of pushed the wheelchair aside and was like, get it out of here, I don't need it, you know, because he's stubborn just like me. And got in the car, we took him home, and, you know, he and I would pretty much try and grab lunch at least once every other week, usually once a week. And I started going back to school, because all my mom ever wanted for me was a college education, you know. And I started going to school. You know, at first I had talked to my sponsor and told him, you know, I'm thinking about taking another semester off just so I can, you know, really get back to working on my program and relearning how to be a normal member of society again. And thank God I have a sponsor who is the way he is. Because he told me, yeah, you know, that's cool. Just say screw the amends you owe your dead mother. But, just twist that knife a bit more there, Joel. But thank God for that, because I wouldn't have listened to anything else, you know. He knows exactly when to pick me up and when exactly to kick my legs out from under me. Thank God for that, man. And started going back to school. Actually, on this past Friday, I finally walked and got my associate's degree. And in the fall, I'm going off for my bachelor's. And I guess the third time really is the charm at college. But, you know, life was going good. You know, I had a good group of friends around me. You know, I had seen my sponsor regularly. He's only one state away from me these days instead of eight. I'm having a great relationship with my dad. Him and I are meeting up all the time. Life was good. And then got a text from a girl, you know. The old story, guy meets girl on a campus. Girl goes back home to, you know, a few states away. Girl texts guy that, hey, you might be the father. And, yeah, it's always a fun one to get. Then talk about a third step exercise there, you know. Because I didn't know what was going on with that, you know. We had to wait until a certain point before we could do a DNA test and all that fun stuff. Because it's kind of like a throw a dart at which guy was it sort of deal. And, you know, I'm just praying the whole time. Because there was a part of me that's like, you know, I would like a child. And I started thinking about what I wanted. You know. And that lasted all about 30 seconds before I realized the road I was going down on my own. You know, just thinking like, what if this, what if that. And what ifs are not a good game for me to play. And finally, I realized where I was going with it. Plug, I'm like, you know, I don't know, God, you got this one. You know, now, some people have these eloquent third step prayers that they say, you know, I've got the one in the book, and all right, God, you got this. That's about the extent of it for me, but it works. Because as soon as I said that, I felt this rush of relief wash over me. And I wasn't worried anymore. And I had this firm belief that no matter what happened, I'd be taken care of, and I'd be shown the way to act right. Turned out it wasn't mine, but again, that relationship with my higher power was still there and still been even more solidified. And that was great. Until, let's see, that fall, I was talking to, I think, Sam earlier about this, you know, a friend and I were backpacking Europe, which is something I never thought I'd get to do. You know, over there for 2.5 weeks, jumping on trains all over the place. It was a fantastic time. And get back, and my dad asked to have lunch with me. I'm like, yeah, of course, Dad. And he kind of sounded a little urgent in it, so, you know, a couple days later we had lunch. And, his cancer had come back. And from what he was telling me, it was pretty bad. His lymph nodes. And, he had a lot of doctor's appointments he had to go to. And, again, I knew where I could lean, and I leaned on people here. You know, people were calling me almost every day asking me how I'm doing. You know, and I'm glad I had just finished my associates that summer, because it's funny how they have you graduate for summer like a year and a half later in spring, whatever. But I wasn't in school at the time. I was able to take care of my dad. And that's what I did. You know, he'd be having 3, 4, 5, 6 doctor's appointments a week, and I'm driving him to all of them. And then he went in for surgery, and they told me to expect, you know, maybe like a 5 or 6 hour surgery, and it was a lot longer than that. When the surgeon finally came out and talked to me after it was over, you know, you never want to hear a surgeon describe cancer as gnarly when he's taking it out, but that's what he said. And he told me that they had to go aggressive with the surgery and everything, but they think they had got it all. And I went back to see my dad. And I held it together for probably about the 15, 20 minutes I was there with him. My dad has always been the rock in my life. He's always been someone I can count on. He's always been there for me, especially once he got sober. You know, he's always been that man I can lean on and look to as an example for me. When I saw him that night, fresh out of surgery, he didn't look that like that man. No. He was weak. You could tell he was in pain. Part of that might have been the anesthesia that it was still in the system and everything, but got to my car and broke down. you know, got to the meeting I'd normally go to on Monday nights, pretty much about 5 minutes after it ended, just to see a couple friends of mine, talk to them briefly, so I wouldn't have to be alone. And, visited my dad in the hospital every day after that. You know, I was, and he was supposed to get released on a certain day, and of course that didn't happen. You know, they were like, oh, well, we need to wait for this, for that, whatever other paperwork, all they had to do. And then, you know, I just had eye surgery to fix my vision, and I couldn't really drive at the time, but we got him home, and I'm showing up for him as best as I can. And then he got released, I think, on a Thursday or Friday. That Saturday night, I'm coming home from a meeting. Actually, Paul right there was driving me. And he's pulling into my driveway, and I get that phone call like, hey, this is so-and-so. I'm an EMT in Montgomery County. You're currently taking your dad to a suburban hospital. He, thank God for friends like Paul, because he looked over at me. You know, it's like 9:30 at night. On a Saturday night, he had much better things to do. But he looked over at me and said, where are we going? You know, we went to the hospital, took care of my dad. They were like, oh, we're going to transfer him down to this hospital. Which, don't get me started on the resentment I had about their paperwork with transferring the patient. But Paul and I stopped off at my dad's place. He helped me clean up my dad's blood that was on the ground because he had a nosebleed that wouldn't stop. And then we went back to the other hospital, waited for him to get released. I think we finally got home around 4:30 in the morning that night. You know, when we were expecting to be home by 9:30. And again, it hit me, I've got friends, like true friends, pretty much brothers. I consider him a brother at least. You know, again, people who will show up for me at the drop of a hat with no thought about what they've got going on. The next weekend, I'm at my home group. It's probably maybe 20 minutes before the meeting starts, and I get that phone call again. Hi, is this Charles Donnelly Justice? Yes. You know it's never good when they use your full name on the phone call. Like, hi, I'm the receptionist here at Sibley Hospital. Your dad's here, and I'm like, all right, great. So I asked a buddy of mine, hey, can you drive me over? He did. Then he dropped me off at my car so I could take my car, and I went to my dad's apartment first to clean it up again for him. And I had a moment of self-pity that I had talked to my sponsor about. I thought for a moment there, I am really getting tired of cleaning up my dad's blood. And then it hit me, like, if I don't do it, who would? You know, if I'm not able to be a son for him, when am I going to do it? Let him come home to that mess? No. Where it says about how God will remove our character defects, which get in the way of usefulness to others, my pride helps me out. Because at that moment, I was too prideful to be that son who wouldn't clean up for his dad. You know, to, like, oh, no, I'm not going to let him come home to this. Pride or not, I still did it. You know, and still picked him up, still took him home. And, you know, the past, I don't know, whether it's been 6, 7, 8, 9 months, I don't know anymore. You know, it's taking him to chemo appointments, taking him to radiation appointments, taking him to ENT docs, all sorts of doctors. And I learned a lot of medical terminology I never thought I'd need to learn. But, you know, I wouldn't trade the world for it. To be able to show up for my dad like that. There was one day when I was over at his place talking to him. And he told me, he said, you know, Charlie, I love the fact that I can count on you to be there for me. Not many people were saying that to me, you know, when I got in here. Because there was a time when I was drinking, my dad had the surgery. I think it was a hip or knee replacement or something like that. And I was supposed to pick him up from the hospital the next day at like 11 in the morning. And I got drunk the night before, and I slept through about 11 phone calls, and he had to take a cab home the next day, fresh out of surgery, because you know, his own son was too drunk and high to pick him up from the hospital. And then he's saying stuff like that to me. You know how he loves how he can count on me. AA didn't give me my life back. You know, AA gave me a new one. One where I can actually be a decent human being today. One where I can show up for people. One where I can be there for those I love. Be a friend. Help people out. You know. And then about a month ago, he was meeting with his doctors. You know, he finally finished his chemo and radiation treatments and all of that fun stuff. You know, like, well, as of right now, you don't have cancer in you. And, you know, whether he did or not, whatever the outcome of that meeting with the doctors was going to be, we both knew I'd be there for him and we'd get through it together, no matter what. I'm happy about the outcome, but I'm even happier that I've been able to be there for him during this time. You know, he's still not through it. There's still a lot of long-term rehabilitation stuff he has to do. You know, a lot of effects from surgery that he's going to have to deal with from the rest of his life. But he knows I'll be there for him. That's something I wouldn't trade for the world. The chance to actually be there for my dad and to be a son for him again. And then he got to see me walk last Friday at graduation. And then that night, he and I were at an AA conference together. Yeah, you know, I like to remember the good times drinking sometimes. Like, oh, I wish I could do that. I know what Tennessee honey smells like. I've never tasted it. And part of me is like, I wonder what it does taste like. But at the same time, I've got a pretty good life today. You know, I'm able to be there for friends when stuff happens to them. You know, my sponsors told me, you're never going to have to go through anything alone. And when I'm complaining about something that's happened to me, he said, you're going to be able to be of service to somebody else with it. And I've had two friends whose moms have died on them. Like, two of my best friends, their moms have died. And I've been able to be there for both of them. You know, I've been able... A friend of mine, he's stubborn like me. And I was like, hey man, let me know when the funeral is. I'd love to be there. And he told me, hey, he's like, yeah, there's just a small thing that we're doing on this day. You don't have to be there. I'm like, whatever, I'll be there. And it's like me and three other people. Turns out we were pallbearers that day, you know. But I'm happy to do it, you know. As much pain or whatever that I felt because of some things that have happened to me, I'm able to be there for other people today. I'm able to be reliable, which is never a word somebody used to describe me. And that's the beauty of this program. You know, so I can get through these things and not have to drink through them. You know, I can get through them and realize that, hey, I get to show up. Not I have to show up, which sometimes it might feel like that, but I get to show up. I get to be there for my dad. I got to be there for my mom. I got to be there for my grandmother. I got to be there for my friends. And I wouldn't trade it for the world. Thanks for letting me share.